Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, second generation president of D'Elia Associates, place where B2B brands go to grow. If you're part of a family-run business, chances are you've had late-night conversations about profit, planning, and yes, the exit. But how often are those conversations rooted in real numbers, actionable insight, and emotional clarity? Our guest today is here to help bridge that gap. He's Rob Ripp, and he's the founder of Fintelligent, a strategic finance firm that helps founder-led and family-owned companies, typically ranging from 2 to 10 million in revenue, gain the financial clarity they need to scale, prepare for exit, or simply boost profitability. With decades of experience in corporate finance, operations, and leadership, Rob brings calm, focus, and structure to what can often be emotionally charged decisions. And I should also add, he's the author of a recently new book, Finance for Founders, an uncommonly fun read on finance that's already earning some great acclaim. His approach is simple but powerful. Take the emotion out of decision-making, focus on the outcomes, and build a business that's ready for whatever comes next. Rob, so great to have you with us. Welcome to Growing Up B2B.
Thank you, Ed. It's wonderful to be here. I'm excited to get started.
Awesome. Awesome. So let's talk a bit about your journey to begin with. What led you to found Fintelligent, and what were the gaps in the market that you were looking to solve by bringing that entity forward?
Sure. I spent my first 10 years of my career in corporate America and knew it wasn't for me. And from there, got my first job as a chief financial officer for a small business, and did that for a few years as a full-time CFO, and then knew some business owners and hung out a shingle as a CFO. I said, let me help you with what you need help with. And their needs were fairly common then and common today. My books are a mess. I need clarity around it. I need a plan to figure out how I'm going to grow my sales and my profit, my cash flow. I just need confidence in my numbers. I just need to do this better. I'm working very hard and don't seem to have a lot of cash. And so I went from being this sole practitioner to building my own firm, where we had to bring in some staff and some processes and some technology to be able to help more founders, which is my mission. Mm-hmm. Help more founders and more business owners get to where they want to be in their journey.
It's always so, I think a lot of times how you treat and regard the numbers in your business is shaped by your experiences. I was probably a few days on the job full time at D'Elia Associates when my dad handed me the month's profit and loss. And so in my journey, I've always looked at profit and loss. I've always looked at balance sheet. I've always looked at the numbers. It's a discipline that we follow every month. Yet, if you didn't come up that way, I'm still running into businesses of more sizable than mine. They're running the business on what their bank account says.
Yes, so, you've seen that too.
Certainly, that's one way to do it.
Oh, yeah, it is.
But I feel like Fintelligent might say, there's probably a better way.
We come into situations like that, and it is fairly common. People reach out to us when they're in pain. And they say, look, I know that this isn't the right way to do it. And they may be making very good money, but they're working very hard. They're taking risk. They want to build their internal cash flow for whatever reason, and they're just not able to do it. And the effort and the things that they were doing before weren't working for them. The companies that we typically work with, they are scaling. They do want to grow. They want to change the way they were doing things before. And so when we go into situations like that, we say, look, you're probably aware that the great companies you read about, the Apples, NVIDIA, so forth and so on, have great structures in place to always track their numbers and be able to continuously improve. We take those same types of systems and mindset and all that and scale it down for growing companies, because at the end of the day, finance is a discipline. It never goes away. So let's apply some process. Let's apply some highly trained people, some great technology to put you on the same path as these great companies, but just at a smaller scale and help you capture more of that money that you're working so hard to earn anyway.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And I got to ask you about the book because it's brand new.
Sure.
Finance for Founders, already earning some appraise. I can't say I've read all the way through, but I read the first few pages. And just to tell our listeners, it's a grabber. It's a grabber.
Thank
it's
you.
A really cool read. So tell me a little bit, what inspired you to write that book, Rob, and who did you write it for?
I love working with founders, and I wrote it for people who are business owners who are scaling their companies. That's why I chose that $2 to $10 million revenue range. And I felt that they were being underserved because there's a lot of startup material out there. Hey, here's how to get started and get going. And certainly there's a lot of focus on the unicorns of the world, the people getting the billion-dollar valuations, raising all this capital. But there are just probably millions of businesses that are providing a great income for people and that are sustainable and they have a great business in $2, $5, $10 million range. And I felt like they just weren't being served. They weren't understanding how to do these things. And their biggest issue is time. These are smart people. These are salespeople and inventors and people that know how to run a business, but they're not accountants. And they know they have a blind spot there. And I felt if I could write a guide where they could be comfortable demystifying what finance is, it would be helpful to them, which is why I deliberately chose to use a story format, because the book tells the story of a journey of a founder who tried to sell her business, failed due diligence. And the reason why is because she didn't know her numbers. The investor told them that. And it's rooted in my own experiences. I mean, I've been in these kinds of situations where people have gotten this feedback. I've also helped people on the other side to sell their companies when they're on their journey with us. And so I brought in the emotional side of it, as well as the financial side. Hey, these are the things we do, but here's why. And here's the impact on you as a business owner, as you evaluate the trade-offs, whether making an investment in your financial system is going to pay off or not.
Awesome. Awesome. So obviously you currently work with a lot of founder-led businesses, but also some that are family-governed businesses. Yep. Talking about the family companies from a moment, what, if any, financial challenges tend to be somewhat more common or more unique on those family-led or multi-generational companies that you work with, Rob?
Sure. The family part of the question is the issue, the family dynamic. And what we see commonly is you'll have family members operating the business and deriving an income. And if the profits are significant, a significant income. And then you may have family members who are more passive investors because they had an uncle or somebody who was in the family, maybe their second or third generation, who they have a stake and they get dividends and they're happy with that. But sometimes they might look at the financials and say, wow, my cousin or my uncle or so-and-so is making an awful lot of money. I feel like I should be making more money. And there's just inherent conflict in that because the objectives are not aligned. Because the people who are making that money are saying, listen, we're growing this business. The reason why you get these dividend checks is because of what we do. And if it's not managed well, there can be a lot of conflict there because it's not about the numbers. It's about the sense of emotion and value. You know, why are you worth more? And why did you get this and that? And it can lead to a lot of friction in a relationship. And so that's something that we see. I'd say the other thing, too, also has to do with the trade-offs that family members that run businesses make of maintaining the family franchise. I got to take care of all these people. I have to make a certain amount of money and investing in the business. Because if you underinvest in the business, you're going to sacrifice future returns. If you overinvest, you're not going to make as much. And that's always a struggle, a trade-off that the family-run companies that we work with, they frequently face.
Are there any times where Fintelligent kind of, or yourself, maybe get brought into some of those discussions as something of an outside force,
sure,
if you will?
So we are very clear, we do not mediate. That's something for lawyers and for other people to handle. What we do see our role as is we're going to evaluate the trade-offs for you, and we're going to talk to the emotional component of it. So if a family-owned business owner comes to us and says, look, we've been paying out a certain level of dividend for a certain amount of time now. People are relying on it. We really want to protect that. I say, okay, if that's your driving concern, then in our financial planning, let's craft something that preserves that. And then when we make these other investments in the business to continue to grow it, because at some point we want to maybe increase that distribution, let's see what that looks like. And more importantly, let's measure it. So if it's not working, let's change it sooner rather than later, do the pivot. Mm. And so we'll present it that way. If they were to say, no, I want to maybe reduce, I want to keep the family piece flat, invest more. So we'll always evaluate the trade-offs. But when they come to us and they say, is asking for more money, our response is going to be, how do you feel about that? What do you want to do? Who are you talking to about it? To inform us as we evaluate these paths, where we think it's going to wind up going. and then tracking and measuring it. So we're not going to pick a side as much as let the founder, let the owners do that and give us guidance so that we can support them in their mission and their objective and be very clear about what those trade-offs, what the costs are and what the rewards are as well, so they can be informed.
Well, in a sense, you have picked a side. The side you picked is the numbers.
It is. That's very true. We are always going to have a bias for data and a bias for the numbers. And our objective is to grow profitability. EBITDA is the most common measure. And our focusing event is the exit. In other words, at some point, the business is going to be sold. And certainly family-owned businesses hearing this podcast now will say, that's not our objective. I'm generation two or three, and we have four getting teed up. But that's still going to be an exit. Yeah. We're all going to exit our businesses someday. And the issue then becomes, when that time arrives, what does the value look like? We don't get into the legality and succession planning and things like that. We're focused on, what do you think is fair value for your efforts? Mm-hmm. And that's expressed as a multiple of EBITDA, because that's what companies get bought and sold for in the open market. And so by maximizing that earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization, by maximizing that profitability, we accomplish two objectives. One is we do add more value when it comes time to exit, you can get a higher multiple. But along the way, you're generating more cash, and cash is freedom. And I think there's one thing, whether you're a founder of a business or whether you're second, third generation, you've taken it over and you're a business owner, you're doing it and taking those risks because you want the freedom. And the profits are expressed as freedom. You have the freedom to choose what you want to do with that excess cash. And that's why we focus on it.
Awesome. Awesome. So speaking of that, when you look at the businesses in that, say, the 2 to 10 million range, where are they often leaving, let's say, leaving money on the table?
Sure.
Where do you see some of the gaps, if you will?
Most commonly pricing. We see people pricing cost plus based on their cost structure. There may be market pricing. And they have opportunities to have more of a value pricing structure because they're adding value to the customer. For example, somebody is in a services business and they find a way to save somebody $100,000. If they would typically charge $10,000, could they have charged $15 or $20? And the answer is we don't know that. But if you change the positioning and maybe even a little bit of the business model, you might be able to capture more of that. And pricing doesn't always get revisited. And especially in more commodity type businesses that are very price sensitive because they think they have a little wiggle room in the marketplace, there could be opportunities to expand pricing through support contracts, other kinds of things that maybe they hadn't thought about before. So pricing is definitely one. I would say the other one is in their financial operations, because that's something we're familiar with. Excuse me. And the issue here is that they don't have a regular process for setting targets, for measuring the variances against those targets, and then holding themselves accountable to making sure that they're on the right track. And just is a very simple matter of, what do we want to do this year in terms of sales and our profit and our cash flow? We can model that kind of stuff. There's a whole bunch of inputs that go in there that we measure to see that they can hit that. But it takes a lot of time. It takes time to develop the plan. But really, the plan isn't activating it, having monthly meetings and getting the data together and so forth and so on. And when you do that, you're going to expand your margins. You're going to make more money. We know it. We see it all the time. But you have to stick to the plan. And sometimes people don't like that. And you also have to have a plan. And sometimes people are like, we're doing fine. We don't really quite need a plan. You're leaving money on the table. The best companies do it. That's why they're always continuously improving. That's why they've got multi-billion and trillion dollar valuations, because that's what their objective is. How do we improve shareholder value? And it comes to the planning and the analysis part.
Do you ever run into situations where, let's just say it's a $2 million company. They're like, all right, next year we're going to be 10. Yeah. And they've got conviction with that.
Yes.
Or you've got to maybe back them up a little and say that's, or at least show them this is what 10 looks like.
Yeah, we do.
Maybe not that dramatic.
Yeah, we would say, show us how you think you're going to get there.
Yeah.
And then I have a conversation that kind of goes like this. I said, look, we're not going to borrow your future. In other words, you're going to be spending money now, like you're going to do $10 million this year. But if that $10 million that's all weighted in the back half, let's say $6, $7 million of it, doesn't materialize, you're going to have a huge cash problem very quickly. So I'm going to tell you in February or March, when you're thinking this way, where things are going. And so to make sure that you don't get mad at me in October, November, when you have a problem, we're going to track along the way. If you're not hitting these numbers, you miss this 1 month, it has a huge impact 4 or 5 months down the road. And we have to adjust for that. And so we'll say, listen, if you want us to put us out that out there, we would probably fight pretty hard not to. But if we lost that battle, we say, listen, let's agree that if you miss a month by even the smallest amount, very low tolerance, we got to make a change. You have to reduce the cost. You have to do something to preserve your cash, or you have to borrow money or raise money somehow because you're not going to have enough cash to do what you want to do. And we start to have those kinds of conversations, again, trade-offs, right? Giving people choices and saying, these are what your options are, and letting them choose, I think gives a lot of business owners exactly what they're looking for in terms of some control and some clarity in the numbers and some confidence that, hey, this makes sense to me. The one thing I will say across the board with our entire customer base, they're very practical folks. They're used to solving problems. They're very resourceful. They're solving a million problems a day. And I think what they need is somebody to talk to them with evidence that says, listen, these are your trade-offs. These are the things you, I'm not saying what you can or can't do. I'm saying if you do this and this happens, you're going to run out of money and you have to do something about that. That's the nature of the conversation.
Awesome. Awesome. So one of the things that you often emphasize is the idea of, and by the way, there's also some great resources on the Fintelligent website, but you can talk about that later.
Sure.
Because I've looked at a few of them, Rob. But this idea is profitability before growth. Why is that so important to you? And how do you help business leaders, owners, whether family governed or not, shift their focus?
That's a great question, because there's this old saying, you've probably heard it before, revenue is vanity and profit is sanity. And it gets back to a comment I made before about this notion of freedom. Cash is freedom. And so the common mistake is this. We go into a situation where sales are great, but they're unprofitable sales. And we can figure that out right away because we'll look at their cost of goods sold. Usually it's misstated. And we'll restate some things and say, listen, you thought you were making a 40 or 50 margin and it's more like a 20. And you're spending like you were a high margin business. That's why you have no cash. And so structurally, they're inefficient. And that's one of the problems that we need to solve.
Quick aside on that. Sure. Expand on that for a moment. Costs of goods sold are mischaracterized.
Yep.
How does that happen? What did they do to? What are some of the?
I'll give you an example.
Okay.
The services please. Business, because we're both in the services business. When you deliver something to a client and you're using labor for it, that labor should be in your cost of goods sold.
Sure.
We have a lot of people that don't do that. Don't put any labor in there. So we go in and allocate that labor. And we'll say, listen, you thought your margins were, because you weren't accounting for it properly, you were spending like you were a 60 margin business, and you're not. You're spending all these other things on top of your people, like you're actually a 30 margin business. And so by not understanding that every dollar of revenue was only generating, say, 40 cents to cover overhead and profit, as opposed to maybe 60 or 70 cents they thought it was, yeah, that's why your bottom line is always going to get squeezed, because you just didn't realize that every dollar you were bringing in was delivering less and less to your bottom line. And so we go to fix that.
Okay. I got it.
Yep. Yeah, so that's what that means. And so what we're trying to do is by keeping the focus on profit.
Yep.
And again, remember, profit times a multiple is a valuation. You know, again, exit at some point down the road, really just helps people. It gives the business owner more options. What do you want to do with this cash? Do you want to pay more out to the family shareholders? Do you want to pay more to yourself? Do you want to invest in the business? You have that option. If there are people that went through some difficult times, and we all do, maybe they've got some debt that they want to retire. Having more cash flow just gives us more options. And that's why we're so profit focused.
Do you ever see scenarios where leadership, or it could be family as well, like stakeholders, are taking too much profit out of the business? Either they're actually taking too much, not leaving enough for the health and sustainability of the company?
We do see those situations. And those are tricky situations because everybody's got a lifestyle and everybody has expectations. And certainly when things are well, we're probably ratcheting things up. And it's always hard to ratchet things back when things aren't going quite so well. And again, it really comes back down to the comfort level of the risk that the owner is taking. And so if they're taking too much out of the business and the business is not growing as a result, we'll have a conversation that says, listen, this is not going to be sustainable for you because costs are just going up, revenue's flatlined, and you're taking more and more out of the business. You have to invest in some things, technology, for example, AI being a big one, to reduce cost, to boost your profits. There are ways, if you're not efficient, you can maintain revenue at some level for maybe a year or two and boost your profits. But that's a one-time thing, especially for smaller companies in our market, $2 to $10 million, growth is growth. That's where the value is driven. And they're tricky conversations. And often, sometimes we'll get a conversation like that and it'll be fine for a few months and then old habits kind of resurface. And so that's a dialogue that's continuing in my experience.
Yeah, that is a tricky one. I know when my father ran the business before me, he was very, let's say, fluid. So he'd pull a lot of money out, but he'd also push a lot of money in. It was almost like a pendulum, and you just swing the pendulum.
Sure.
And he was comfortable with that. I wasn't so comfortable. So I was more about let's regulate and let's make things a little bit more consistent.
I agree. And I have the same philosophy. We recommend to all of our business owner customers that they set up a line of credit, even if they don't have one. We believe the best time to borrow money is when you don't need it. But it does give you an opportunity, if things go south, to tap into some cash to smooth out those bumps without having to scramble, without having to reach into your own pocket and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was one of the things that, you know, that I ultimately did, because his line of credit like was tiny. I'm like, why? Yeah. That's nothing, man. That doesn't even pay for a month.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, a subject we've touched on several times on the conversation, Rob, is the idea of an exit. Mm-hmm. And it is on every leader's mind, whether it's top of mind or back of mind, but it's in there. So thinking about some of the family businesses you've worked with, what are some of the most common like misconceptions family business leaders might have when they're starting to really put that exit idea top of mind, front of mind, and starting to prepare for an eventual either transfer of ownership or exit?
I think one is that it's going to be easy and straightforward. It rarely is. Whether you're family owned or not, it is a process that does take some time and can be time consuming. But I think in the family situation, it is being considerate of those family dynamics. And I think you have a much greater emotional component to it, especially for the people who would be purchasing the business. So if it's going to the next generation, they could be your kids, they could be nieces, nephews, things like that, and what it means to them. And also within that cohort, if there's multiple people, there's going to be somebody that's going to probably be running the company someday, the CEO, the first among equals. And so in the succession plan itself, there's that emotional side that you kind of have to deal with. On the valuation side, which is where we advise, we're looking to find ways to maximize that exit valuation. And that manifests itself in something called the Rule of 40. And the Rule of 40 is very simply your revenue annual growth rate, call it 20%. And let's say your EBITDA profit margin, your percentage of revenue, call that 20%. Add those two up, that's 40%. Anything over that gives you a higher multiple and gives you a higher value, makes you more attractive. But the idea behind that is, as a family-owned business owner, if you want to develop, if you want to get what you think is fair out of your business, you have to have a number in mind. And you have to think about the metrics that any buyer would apply to that to get you your number. Because whether it's a financial buyer, strategic buyer, or a family member, at some point, you're probably going to have somebody come in and do a valuation on that business. And the valuation is going to be based on the things that the market is doing to value businesses like that, regardless of the type of buyer. And so if you're going to be relying on a valuation to do that, you can best position yourselves by having strong revenue growth rates, showing that demand is there, and strong profit margins. Hey, we're good at generating cash flow. We can cover our bills and leave a lot left over for profit distributions.
Nice. So when a company that I'll say is well prepared for that exit in terms of what they look like, it sounds if they have that Rule of 40 covered, they're probably looking good. Is there anything else that they need to? And I guess there's some standardization of reporting so they can actually show the numbers and demonstrate, you know, that they have a means to track and drive growth in the business. Is there anything else that a well-prepared company typically represents as, in your opinion, if they're going to exit?
They prepare for due diligence. And what that means is that they have all their contracts signed, organized, verifiable. They have contracts with all their customers or purchase orders or some evidence that they are properly engaged. They've got their employees set. Key employees maybe have some employment contracts. There's so much to due diligence that can go wrong. Even if it's just going to be a transfer to the next generation, you want to make sure that you've got the legal side done. You want to make sure that your financials are tight. You want to make sure that it's understood. Even if you're doing it, again, passing the next generation, if you've got a clean sort of knowledge store of your business, from the legal to the policies, to the IT, to the financials and everything like that, it becomes a place where the new generation can anchor on and say, okay, I'm new here. I didn't know about this customer before or this, that, or the other thing. What do we really have going on here? It could be useful, I think, to train them or develop them in their new role post-close or post-transfer. So maintaining, we call it a data room, there's checklists out there that people can grab. We have one that we can share that says, hey, if you organize your data this way, it can become the basis by which you make sure that there's an orderly transfer. Because typically when the one generation cycles out or gives it to another family member, they do stick around for some period of time. Mm-hmm. And rather than having constant meetings with this person just dumping all their knowledge on people, you now have a written store of knowledge that you can draw upon. And with AI, you can have people search it and get great information and maybe not only make it more relevant and deeper, maybe save some of the meetings or some of the things that might be communicated verbally that could be missed. There's still a place for the meetings, but it's a way to just make you a little bit more efficient. And so we do recommend people be prepared for due diligence, even if it's going to be
Excellent.
a transfer to another generation that's familiar with the company.
And if a company is looking to exit, what I'm guessing when you come to them, they probably don't have all their ducks in a row. So they got stuff they need to do. So I'm guessing that probably pushes the time horizon of really taking the company to market out. What
We do.
you know, I
We've done
mean.
it. Yeah, we've done it as little as 12 months, but we like 18 to 24 months. And where we sit is we're squarely on the side of management. So our job is to close the deal, but we don't source or negotiate deals. That's the job for an investment banker or a mergers and acquisitions advisor, an M&A advisor. And we strongly recommend to all of our owners that are considering selling to an external constituent to engage an M&A advisor, because that person ideally will run an auction process, get multiple bids, and help negotiate not just the valuation of the company, but the terms as well. And terms matter. Somebody might sell their business for $10 million, but if it's $1 a year for 10 million years, that's not a good sale. So having a good M&A advisor does that. And then when it comes around to due diligence or even getting the initial letter of intent, we're getting involved because the buyers want to know, what do the numbers look like? Do they make sense? Are they well prepared? Are they representing to me in the due diligence I'm doing now what they told me in their confidential information memorandum, the shiny deck that said they could do all this stuff? Is their alignment there? And that's where we start to get in the weeds and get very forensic about how we can respond to these things, but also speak the buyer's language and talk about, hey, this is what's in it for you, and help cement the story with data that the business owner is telling to maximize their exit.
Nice. So it's in a very different way, we function in the same capacity in terms of preparing for exit, because if it takes that CEO 10 minutes to explain their value proposition,
Yeah,
they're
exactly.
like, okay, we might need to do some work here.
Yeah, well, a
And then
huge marketing component to marketing a deal, absolutely. And the thing is, too, people have to understand selling your company is not like selling your product. It's a very different process. And again, that's where a well-trained, very experienced mergers and acquisitions advisor is key, because they will help you with that story. And they know what investors are looking for when they look to buy a company. We've seen that happen before, especially with technical folks, people that own, say, software companies or tech companies. They're not getting the features and benefits of their product. Buyer doesn't care about that. They care about cash flow, especially financial buyers, like private equity buyers. They're thinking, how do I take this thing and flip it in 3 to 5 years for five times more than I'm buying it for right now? Very different motivation.
Very interesting point. And another point you brought up briefly, but I'd like to expand on a little bit. You mentioned AI. Are you seeing business leaders that you're working with beginning to adopt AI or data tools in their financial processes? And if so, where do you see some of the opportunities to meaningfully bring AI in a constructive way into the financial component of the business?
Very much. And I'd say our more tech forward clients are already talking to us about it. And one of the areas that's interesting, I say maybe two, is this notion of AI doing your bookkeeping, your day-to-day bookkeeping, where it can plug into your banking systems, automatically classify transactions, book them into QuickBooks Online, something like that, and no longer have a bookkeeper do that kind of work. And there are companies out there right now that are doing those kinds of things. And the idea is that you interact with this AI agent like you would a bookkeeper, but right now you're typing it, you probably speak it, but that's developing, that's happening, and that's very interesting. Then there are things like AI within QuickBooks Online itself. You can start to ask your books questions. Hey, what was my 3-year monthly revenue rate for between this time period? And it'll give you those answers. And so what we're seeing is embedding in the financial tools that people are using, the ability to go and query it. What's interesting is that the tech-forward people and self-starters, the do-it-yourselfers, they'll do that. But most of our customer base wants to talk to somebody who's an expert in this, because finance is a blind spot for them. And as long as it's a blind spot, AI can only do so much to get them comfortable. Because I think at the end of the day, what we're doing is we're selling business owners comfort in their numbers. Because we see things that AI can't see, and AI, it can hallucinate. It will give you wrong information,
Yes, it will.
and so you have to be careful of that. So you can't rely on it too exclusively. And so they may adopt some AI, but they do want somebody, a human with financial expertise, to look at it and say, "Does this pass a smell test? Like, does this make sense to you?" And we'll know pretty quickly whether it does or doesn't. AI has a place. It is coming. It's here. We've embraced it ourselves, but we do see certainly in the short and medium term a need for a human assist to help founders and help business owners understand more about their financial picture.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think the right future for AI for a lot of businesses. In my industry, everybody swings the pendulum really far. That's just the nature of our industry. It's, oh, it's going to be the next. And it is definitely the next evolution of our industry, as it is for many. This is an interesting one where it's really not just centralized to the greater marketing services, but so many businesses. And you know, our position is it's really going to be hybrid. It's going to be
I agree. Human
and AI agent collaborations that are going to be where it settles out. At least that's my humble opinion.
I absolutely agree. What AI is a great time saver. And I'll look at a use case maybe in your business, like writing the blog post. We know that we want to say certain things. We want to deliver it in a certain voice. We want it to align with our corporate messaging and things like that. And AI can do it. But if you had AI write it, pretty much everybody who reads it is going to know that AI wrote it. And so, you know, what the human assist does is it goes and it makes it theirs. It gives us some ideas and maybe sparks the creativity. And so maybe a blog post that would take us 2 hours to write takes us half an hour. It still takes us some time. And we're adding our own little special sauce to it or whatever we need to do. But that's still a big time saver. That's 75% time savings.
Yeah.
It's a great product, maybe even better than if you try to just gut it out on your own. But I believe that AI is always going to augment our experience and not necessarily replace it unless it has so many rules that it can be replaced. But a lot of people don't like to do strictly rules-based stuff. Anyway, we've automated that. We've been doing it for years. Raw data entry, reconciliations, things like that we do. Yeah, I could see AI maybe replacing that. But then those people might become analysts and they might become more of what we do for people, talking to customers saying, okay, this is why this happened. Or maybe there's some research that needs to happen, something a little bit more special and more value added that frees them up to do because they're not just busy banging out data and all that kind of stuff.
Cool. So I wonder if you could share, and without naming names due to confidentiality, maybe a client story or a transformation that really illustrates the power of getting the financial side of the business truly dialed in.
Yes. So earlier this year, we helped sell one of our customers' companies for life-changing money. And he admitted, like, we never would have been here without you. And we helped with the deal, which was great, but we helped them get a deal. And again, it was getting back to those early discussions, knowing what investors are looking for from the very first interaction. And he was well represented, and we work well with M&A advisors to make sure that before we even started the process, we were ready to respond. And we did the work. And it's clarity in your numbers, financials that make sense. No investor is going to grind through a four-page P&L trying to piece things together. They want it tight. They want it summarized. They want somebody to explain it to them, and they want somebody to vouch it. Prove to me that these numbers are true and why. So they'll look at the processes. How often we're meeting? What does the budget look like? What are your variances? So forth and so on. And so when they were ready and they started getting information from us to support their investment thesis, which is the letter of intent, now you get into due diligence. And now it's, okay, you got us this far. Prove to us you can cross the finish line. Because due diligence is grueling. They ask the same questions over and over. Everything is very compressed because you want to keep the deal moving. Time kills deals. So if somebody says they want something, they generally want it yesterday. And there's a lot of emotion involved because it's life-changing money. But we got over the finish line. And again, it was somebody who was prepared for exit well in advance of the exit and then executed the things they needed to do during the exit process to get the valuation that they were thrilled with.
That's a great story. And it also illustrates that you and Fintelligent can only do so much. If there's not a willing counterpart in your client who's saying, I'm willing to do, you know, to walk it out with you in the right way, it may not get there. But in this case, it sounds like the collaboration was there across the board.
And we look for that when we're talking to prospects. Because, listen, there's plenty of business owners that have a great business. They're comfortable with it. They may not have a sense of urgency. And it's more of a lifestyle business. And that's fine. But we tend to focus on people who want to scale their companies and sell them. That's just the niche that we've chosen. Yeah. And so there's room in the market for all of that. But when we find people that are motivated to exit for whatever reason, then it changes the conversation. It changes the dynamic a little bit. They get a little bit more coachable because they're saying, okay, this is it. This is the payoff. This is what I've been working 10, 20, 30 years for. And I don't want to mess this up. And they know they negotiate against people typically that are far better at buying companies than they will ever be at selling them. Look at the professional buyers out there, right? The people work for PE companies or even strategic partners that grow through acquisition. I mean, they've done dozens of deals and you're competing for their mind share for that. So having them on board, willing to be coachable and flexible and being very clear about how difficult the process is important. And we say, listen, if you're not ready for it, that's fine. But if you're ready for it, this is what it looks like.
Yeah.
Make sure you're ready if you want the outcome that you want to have, because it's not easy.
Got it. Got it. So, looking out to the future a little bit, what's next for you and the Fintelligent team? Any new projects, tools, ideas, anything that you're really excited about right now,
Oh,
Rob?
yeah, very much. So we are growing, and the book certainly has generated some interest in the company. And the book talks about what we do and our approach and what the outcome can be. And we want to adopt that more in our messaging and in the way we work and the products that we offer. And so we're in the process now of a refresh where we're updating our website. We're looking at our product portfolio. We've implemented a new professional services administration system, a PSA system, so we can have greater alignment around our products and what our customers need and how we actually go about doing our work. And of course, we're embracing AI, both to generate things like financial analyses and copy and whatever it might be. And we're also calling, or what is also called agentic AI, which is automated things, like I mentioned before, on the bookkeeping. Hey, here's a task for you to go do. So instead of me having to manually do, say, a bank reconciliation, the agent will do it, saving us time to work on more value-added kinds of things. So we're very excited by that. And the opportunity to help more founders, we're very founder-focused, is really what kind of keeps us going, because I have this personal mission to at least help one founder a day. And if their client's great, and if not, that's fine too. But they're just such a dynamic, innovative, fun group of people. They're great to work with. It keeps me running to the office every day.
You got a lot going on, man. That's
We
awesome.
do. We
That's
do.
very
Thank you.
exciting.
Thanks. Yeah.
It's an exciting time to be part of the Fintelligent team. So
It is. I think
that's
so.
cool. That's really
Yeah.
cool.
Thanks.
So finally, what's if one of our listeners really wanted to connect with you, or hey, maybe grab a copy of Finance for Founders, the new
Yep.
book, what's the best way for them to connect, Rob?
Sure. My email address, rob.rip@fintelligent.com. I'm also on LinkedIn. We're on Instagram, the socials, things like that. Our website is www.fintelligent.com. And the book has its own website for now, and that's www.finforfounders.com. So finforfounders.com. The book is called Finance for Founders: The Journey to Unlocking Your Company's Wealth. It's available right now on Amazon. You can get it on Kindle, paperback, hardcover. We're going to have an audiobook coming out probably late August, so you can listen to it in the car on your way to work. And there's a bunch of resources around the book where you can take some assessments. Is your accounting up to speed? Is your reporting where you want it to be? As well as download some tools where we could see, okay, this is what my P&L should look like, or here's a sample financial report, or here's some examples of financial analyses that I could have done for me to help me understand better how I can drive more profit in my company. So we really try to make it something that was easy to read, but also had some useful tools in it that founders could take a look at and say, hey, this might be something that could work for me. Let's reach out to Rob and his team and have a conversation.
That's awesome that you did that and put it such a great, not just a great book, but a great package together to help enrich
Thanks.
the founders out there. And certainly some of them will be saying, gosh, we better just talk to this firm because they seem to know a heck of
That's what we're hoping
a
for. It's why I don't build houses but move into them. I'd love to maybe do it, but somebody's so much better at it than I am. We'll just pay them and do that. Go to restaurants, whatever it may be. So that's what we're trying to do here, is just really kind of help people and get them comfortable. And if they want to come on board, we're more than happy to help have them join us and
Awesome.
help out.
Rob, hey, thank you so much for sharing your insight and your experience, not just the financial side, but on how to lead with clarity and plan with intention. Again, we've been speaking with Rob Ripp, founder of Fintelligent and author of the new book, Finance for Founders, a go-to resource for leaders looking to unlock profitability and prepare for what's next. And I'm Ed D'Elia, and this is Growing Up B2B. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Rob, thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you, Ed. I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
All right. Hey, thanks so much for tuning into Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.deleonet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at deleonet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.